Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. Today's Courthouse Steps decision program will be discussing the recent 8-1 decision in Childs v. Salazar, which the Supreme Court released this past week. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Associate Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society. We are honored to have a fantastic panel of legal experts here today to discuss this important decision. I will briefly introduce them, but you can access their full and very impressive bios on our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. First off, we have Paul Avila, who is a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. Then we have Professor Stephanie Barclay, Professor of Law and Faculty Co-Director with the Georgetown Center for the Constitution at the Georgetown University Law Center. Our distinguished moderator today is Casey Maddox, Vice President for Legal Strategy at Stand Together. If our audience has any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen and not the chat so that we'll be able to access them later in the program. With that note, I will turn things over to our moderator to start today's discussion. Casey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Libby. Thanks to FedSoc for hosting this, and thanks to our panelists for doing this. Obviously, on short notice, the decision just came out on Tuesday, but this is the same panel that brought you the preview of the decision. So here we are to talk about the postmortem. What has happened now that we do have a decision in the Childs case? And as Libby mentioned, it's an 8-1 decision. We're going to go first. Professor Barclay, can you give us just sort of a rundown of what the court did decide on Tuesday?
Sure. And thanks for having me. And thanks for putting this together. I think this case is a really important victory for freedom of speech protections. In Childs versus Salazar, the court held 8-1 that Colorado's conversion therapy ban, as applied to licensed talk therapists, is regulating speech based on viewpoint and therefore demands far more rigorous First Amendment scrutiny than the rational basis approach that had been applied by the lower courts below. So the court emphasized the fact that Ms. Childs was allowed to engage in talk therapy that would have been affirming of a patient or client's desire to pursue a gender transition, but Colorado would not allow Ms. Childs to engage in talk therapy for a client who sought to avoid something like a gender transition and instead grow more comfortable in the body that they were born with. And importantly, Ms. Childs, it was important to the court, Ms. Childs is seeking to help clients accomplish their own goals, not impose goals on them. So this is voluntary talk therapy only. There's no other sorts of drugs or physical interventions that are involved. And that's important because Justice Jackson, as the lone dissenter, was arguing, as Colorado had been, this is just conduct that's not subject to First Amendment protection. And the Supreme Court said the First Amendment is not a labeling game. Just because government calls something conduct doesn't transform it into conduct when all we're dealing with are words coming out of someone's mouth. So writing for 8 justices, Justice Gorsuch stressed that point that we can't just transform it into conduct just because it's a treatment by licensed professionals. Those licensed professionals still retain First Amendment rights. Colorado failed to identify any sort of historical tradition of content regulation as an exception to that default norm of professionals being able to retain First Amendment rights and to justify a diminished protection. And so the court ultimately reversed and remanded for further proceedings under the correct strict scrutiny standard, the most rigorous standard the First Amendment offers. Didn't tell us how strict scrutiny will go, though the court said a lot of things about how viewpoint discrimination, the type of discrimination at issue in this case, is the most suspect and the most problematic under the law. The only two courts to address this so far, the Sixth Circuit and the 11th Circuit, under the appropriate standard, have said that this type of application of the laws is unconstitutional. And I think Colorado is going to have a steep uphill battle below in further proceedings. Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor joined the opinion in full. Justice Kagan also wrote separately to flag that it's possible that a content-based but viewpoint-neutral regulation of professional speech would present different constitutional issues, and signaling that not all regulation of therapeutic speech is necessarily foreclosed. And of course, one other thing I'll flag about the majority's ruling in this case is because this is just an as-applied ruling, not facial invalidation, it means that states like Colorado can continue to prohibit lots of different types of things that all the parties in this case agree are problematic. Aversive treatments, coercive treatments, things like shock therapy, that can still be prohibited. The application of this case is just about voluntary talk therapy that the government is trying to regulate in a viewpoint discriminatory way.
Thank you. Paul, I'm going to come to you. First of all, feel free to reply, add on to anything that you just heard. But I also wanted to ask you particularly, is this the end of the professional speech doctrine? Is this the, after NIFLA, it seemed like it was probably dead, but it's sort of the ghoul in the night sort of situation from Scalia's terminology that just seems to keep going, despite the fact that the court seems to keep saying that it's not looking kindly upon it. What's your take on that? And feel free to respond to anything else you just heard.
My take on that is that NIFLA was supposed to be the nail in the coffin for this. And I think what was happening in the lower courts is that they were struggling with, for whatever reason, a particular exception that NIFLA was talking about when it came to professional speech, and that was the speech incidental to conduct idea. In NIFLA, the court said, look, the speech of professionals is, of course, speech. It's protected as speech. There are some ordinary rules of speech jurisprudence. One of those rules, however, is that speech, the regulation of speech incidental to the regulation of conduct is not fully protected as speech. And a lot of courts were misunderstanding, I think, what that was. And so I think the best thing about this decision, about the majority's decision, is the degree to which it really clarifies what speech incidental to conduct means and what it doesn't mean. And I think that really accounts for the difference between the 8 majority and the 1 dissent, which Justice Jackson's dissent is really the professional speech doctrine reapplied. And it's the professional speech doctrine reapplied because her take on it is that any regulation of speech within a larger regulatory sphere, a regulation that encompasses both conduct and speech, or a regulation of, say, a general practice that includes speech, that just means if you look at it that way, regulations of speech are incidental because what the government is mostly regulating is conduct. And NIFLA said, that's not what NIFLA said. And the majority does an excellent job of really walking through the relevant cases, especially Cohen v. California and Holder v. Humanitarian Law, to say, no, that's not the right inquiry. The right inquiry is, what is the speaker doing? It's a speaker-based inquiry. And so I think that is the most important part of this decision. Really, I think putting to bed the misunderstanding of speech incidental to conduct doctrine, and going forward, the rest of these cases should be fairly easy to sort out. Although, as Stephanie noted, like, there's still going to be questions as to, okay, we're in strict scrutiny land now. What are the interests and how do we do the balancing?
That's right. So, yeah, and obviously, this case is not over. In strict scrutiny is often deemed, fatal in fact, is how the court has described it. At least sometimes in the past, that oftentimes when these cases are, when strict scrutiny is applied, that's usually the very often the end of the analysis, but it's not technically over, right? This case goes back now to the lower court for the actual application of strict scrutiny, I guess, either to the 10th Circuit at first glance. I would imagine that the 10th Circuit then sends it back to the district court and ask the district court judge to apply strict scrutiny. Is that the assumption?
Right. Well, this came up as a PI, as an appeal from a PI.
Right. That's
so
right. Right. Yeah.
We're not even at the final judgment stage of any of this yet.
That's yeah. Right. And I think it's quite possible that the 10th Circuit doesn't need to send it back for trial proceedings. The 10th Circuit very well may, out of prudence, but I don't think there's any legal reason why they need to, because Colorado had the opportunity to introduce evidence in the trial proceeding below. I don't think they did a very good job, but that's not like a legal reason why they get a second bite at the apple at doing evidentiary introduction of, you know, different experts or declarations or reports, and their own evidence at trial below acknowledged, one of their experts acknowledged that, and one of their reports acknowledged that they could not establish causation between harm and the type of therapy at issue in this case. And some Supreme Court precedent, including a case called Brown, require under strict scrutiny that that sort of evidentiary burden be met, that if the state's arguing that its actions are necessary to avoid some sort of harm. And I would say that that's different than balancing. It's more like the state has some permissible harms it can avoid, and then it has to prove on an evidentiary basis that in fact its actions are linked to that. They have to show through causation that sort of link. And they haven't here. I think they will have an uphill battle showing that sort of evidence here, because they weren't able to point to a single study or survey that singled out this type of therapy. All of the surveys they pointed to were either looking at things like shock therapy, coercive therapy, aversive therapy, or some mix, but none of them that could single out voluntary talk therapy by a licensed professional with aligner and show that therapy causes harm, which is why I think the Sixth and the 11th Circuit said, yeah, this easily fails strict scrutiny when we're looking at the appropriate legal standard.
The state can't just sort of say, we have a compelling interest, generally speaking. And therefore, in your individual case, we have a compelling interest in applying that that standard to you, right? That it's got to be tailored to the actual conduct that's occurring from the person that they're looking to try to apply that that law to.
Not conduct.
Especially when we're dealing with an challenge.
Yes, right. So one thing that sort of divides the small divide between the majority or the main opinion, the six justices, and then the concurrence from Kagan and Sotomayor. Kagan and Sotomayor indicate at least sort of, you know, well, in another case, there would be some possibility that maybe a content-based but viewpoint-neutral law, which Colorado's is not, but one that actually said, just, you know, you can't do this kind of therapy in either direction with regard to sexual orientation and gender identity, right? That might be a different case. I'm curious if you have thoughts on that. I think one of the interesting things to me in that is always, because this language occurs all the time in these First Amendment cases, talking about how content discrimination gets you to strict scrutiny generally. Viewpoint discrimination is even worse. So you might say, wow, then that's got to even be worse than strict scrutiny, right? You've got to have an even more elevated level of scrutiny. And the answer is, well, no, it's worse, but we still just apply strict scrutiny. So I'm curious kind of how you look at that interplay between the justices there, the six and the two.
So Justice Kagan's opinion, I think, is in line with a couple of other things that she has said about what are we really doing when we're looking at content-based restrictions on speech. It's actually, I think, consistent with her law review article that was written back in 1996 on the importance of government motivations. And really what we're trying to do is ferret out government motivation, because we're really concerned about bad motivations. And so she says, look, there are sometimes the content-based laws don't trigger strict scrutiny because we're less concerned about the government's motivation. And this is really a pre-Reed v. Town of Gilbert idea of what content-based regulation or law really is and what they're really concerned about. But you do find echoes of it, I think, more recently in the court's trademark cases of Vidal, Tam, and those cases where in Vidal, the court upheld said a content-based regulation related to trademarks didn't trigger strict scrutiny because history and tradition meant that the two lived side by side. And so this elevated scrutiny was not proper for content-based regulations, but was proper for viewpoint-based regulations. That was written by Justice Thomas, who was also the author of Reed v. Town of Gilbert, which recast in much stronger terms the distinction between content or what is a content-based regulation. And so I do think there's some tension here, but there is sort of this longer train of thought that hasn't hasn't been majority opinions recently, but getting to this distinction that maybe there is some differences.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, and interesting to think about what would a viewpoint neutral sort of law look like here, but still content based. So the majority opinion repeatedly frames its holding in viewpoint specific terms and talks about how, you know, Colorado here has gone a step further beyond content based to prescribe what views Ms. Childs may or may not express, and that this is an egregious form of content regulation where the concerns are most blatant. And Justice Kagan has written about elsewhere that one of the reasons we're most concerned about viewpoint based regulation is because it suggests that, you know, there's something more about just a disagreement with that position. That type of government censorship is afoot, one of the things that's antithetical to First Amendment freedoms. The closing paragraph of the majority frames the holding around any effort to prescribe an orthodoxy of views when it comes to laws that suppress speech based on viewpoint, very much in that sort of vein. So the majority opinion does preserve the two NIFLA categories of permissible content-based professional speech, which suggests that, like, not all content-based regulation is going to be okay. It still has to fit in these categories: compelled disclosure of factual, non-controversial information in commercial speech, and also laws that only incidentally burden speech or burden conduct. They're regulating conduct, and they're only incidentally burdening the speech that is related to that. And they also talk about speech that is inherently bound up in conduct. And of course, there's the Casey example of informed consent necessary for a medical procedure. So Colorado's law fit into none of those sorts of categories. And the court also suggested that there might be room to recognize other sorts of categories if there's some long tradition of content-based regulation. And here they just said Colorado fell far short of any of the three different attempts that they made to show that sort of history that's permissible for content regulation. So when it comes to number one, medical licensing, the court said, first, the pedigree is just way too thin. The first counselor licensing bill was only adopted in 1976. That's far from the sort of persuasive evidence of a historically grounded practice that our precedents require. And those sorts of regulations, even if they were old enough, they address qualifications of who can practice, not the viewpoints of who gets to say something. The second potential category of historical content-based regulation they looked at was informed consent. And the court here distinguishes informed consent laws on two grounds, that those laws are, again, regulating speech only incident to the separate physical conduct that the government can lawfully regulate, like the Casey medical procedure. And as applied here, Colorado's law isn't regulating any conduct. It's only Ms. Child's words coming out of her mouth. And second, those informed consent laws typically require disclosures of, again, just factual and uncontroversial information. And third, Colorado attempted to link this to malpractice, and the court pointed out three structural differences with malpractice. Malpractice requires exacting proof. The plaintiff has to demonstrate an injury that was caused by the breach of the duty of care. And there's nothing like that here. But those sort of proof requirements, the court was careful, I think, not to say that that means malpractice lawsuits will always satisfy the First Amendment. But they did say that that provides a different type of breathing room for protected speech that puts those laws on different constitutional ground than the laws at issue here, where a law that requires no proof of injury at all and threatens sanctions simply for expressing the particular view, and that's it. Also, Colorado's law is a categorical ex ante prohibition. Malpractice operates after the fact with individualized liability. And malpractice sometimes permits clients to consent to treatments that depart from the prevailing standard of care. Colorado's law allows for no such consent. One theme of all of these arguments that the court points out is that Colorado was just operating at way too high of a level of generality to try and establish some history and tradition-based exemption from these prohibitions against content-based regulation. So all that is to say, there may be ways in which content-based regulation would be permissible, but they're pretty small categories, even though they're different on different constitutional grounds than the much more egregious viewpoint regulation.
We'll note we have over 100 people in the watching right now. We have no questions yet in the Q&A. So if you are watching and have questions, please feel free to use that function, drop your questions there, and we'll certainly try to get to those. So one thing that sort of raised, reading that section, I realized that the court did, you know, had some of this kind of language, the sort of history, tradition language of these kind of categories of exempted speech in the NIFLA opinion as well. But it seemed to me like this seems to be a growing approach of a trying to apply the kind of originalist methodology to this question. Curious if this did seem to either of you to be going a kind of a step further in this with this query, and maybe if that's kind of an illustration of the development of the court's approach on this text, history, tradition sort of approach to understanding constitutional provisions and applying it in the First Amendment context here, or if I'm hallucinating.
I don't know that this goes any farther than NIFLA. I mean, NIFLA really lays out all of these same ideas more in a shorter fashion, to be sure. But I don't view Childs as going any further than what NIFLA did. It really, Childs is kind of boring. It's just an application of NIFLA. And in doing so, it clears up, I think, this incidental regulation idea. I think that's the big move of this case more than anything else. But I don't see any daylight between this and NIFLA at all.
I do think that the court here is spending more time talking about potential ways in which history might point us to some exceptions to the First Amendment doctrine. So I don't see those as being in tension. I'd agree with Paul in that sense. It's building on NIFLA. But in NIFLA, the court doesn't spend as much time talking about ways in which, if there's been this long history of things like medical licensing or informed consent or malpractice at the right level of generality that are similar enough, that might suggest a different type of constitutional protection here. So that's the court did seem to be leaning in more to figuring out ways to use history to shape First Amendment doctrine without jettisoning, important First Amendment doctrine that exists, like strict scrutiny. The court doesn't seem to have an appetite from shifting away from that doctrine here. And Justice Barrett has said in other contexts that even where the court is incorporating more originalism, doctrines like strict scrutiny in the First Amendment context that are well established probably aren't going anywhere anytime soon. I think you see that here, but fleshing that out with more historical analysis is something that seems to be important to this court.
Well, you mentioned, Paul, as you were discussing NIFLA, I mean, one of the things that stood out to me is the fact that Justice Kagan, in this opinion, is fully joins the majority. We've got 8 votes, and it's an opinion that relies heavily upon NIFLA, points to NIFLA, says, as you noted, it doesn't really move the ball very much in a lot of ways from NIFLA. Justice Kagan dissented in NIFLA. She was on the other side of that case. And not only that, I think about a week later in the Janus opinion, cited NIFLA as an example of weaponizing free speech. And so that justices changed their views, and they're permitted to do that. They also just sort of like come to accept that this is the rule, and therefore precedent's important. I mean, either of you have a sense of, is this part of a sort of shift from Justice Kagan potentially in this case? Is this a reality of the shift in the overall makeup of the court? Is it a precedent thing? Kind of what's your sense of what might be driving her vote here?
So
go ahead.
You want to go first, Paul?
No, go ahead.
I think there's both a doctrinal explanation and then also maybe like a real politique explanation. So in NIFLA, as you point out, Kagan joined Breyer's dissent, but they were arguing that Colorado's law was different. So they didn't view Colorado's law as viewpoint-based discrimination. They were
California's arguing, law in that case, right? California. Yeah, right.
California's law and NIFLA. And NIFLA, of course, is dealing with a situation where California is requiring pro-life pregnancy centers to post notices informing clients that the state provides free or low-cost abortions. And she and Breyer were making more arguments about ways in which this was a compelled disclosure of factual information about existing government programs, not a compelled endorsement of abortion. So on that reading, I think Kagan and Breyer are taking the view that this isn't this is content-based, but viewpoint neutral. So it's sort of the type of distinction she's saying in her concurrence in Childs could be okay. Now she's taking a broader view of what can count as being viewpoint neutral than I think the majority would. And so it's debatable whether that sort of distinction holds, but nevertheless, to the extent that, you know, in her head, she's being consistent about that. I think that's then consistent with her saying, and here it definitely is viewpoint discrimination. Like maybe we debate about it being viewpoint neutral there, but this definitely isn't. This is viewpoint discrimination. And so now I'm coming down on the side of recognizing that where viewpoint discrimination exists, then it's more likely that an attempt to impose government orthodoxy is afoot. The real politic answer is also she may have hoped that by joining the opinion that would result in a narrower opinion. And so there was some value to shaping what was going on as opposed to just dissenting. But I do think doctrinally, she probably really believes that there's a consistency here between the two positions she took.
Yeah, I think two further points, I think, along those same themes. One is that NIFLA is a compelled speech case. In NIFLA, the speaker was not prohibited from speaking. It's that if they said certain things, they had to say other things that the government wanted them to say. And there are some notions out there, I don't think this is right, but there's some notion out there that compelled speech is less offensive than prohibited speech, because in prohibited speech cases, you are silenced, whereas in compelled speech, you can still get your statement out there. Again, not sure that's right, but there are some people who think that. I think the other thing too is that since NIFLA came down in 2018, I think the idea that states would then impose viewpoint restrictions on licensed professionals has become quite more commonplace or visible. Of course, you had everything to do with COVID. You have, of course, conversion therapy cases. You have gender affirming care cases. There was a case out of the Eighth Circuit called Brandt that was, as it was called at the oral argument in this case, the mirror image of this case, where you could have a conservative state say that doctors were not allowed to do certain kinds of talk therapy based on viewpoints that they didn't like. And there's a longer history here too. There's, you know, the Wolfschlager case out of the 11th Circuit from several years ago that had to do with doctors at asking their patients about guns. And would that have been a content-based or a content-neutral kind of regulation? And so I just think that there's this awareness out there that in fact, as was warned about in NIFLA, states have used their regulatory power over licensing to begin to impose certain viewpoints out there. And I don't think I don't think the eight are super happy about that.
Can I just add really quickly to that? I agree that NIFLA was dealing with compelled speech and this is dealing with prohibited speech in a way, but I think Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion in NIFLA that Kagan joined said, even if we were dealing with compelled speech where California had said, you must say that you endorse abortion, Justice Kagan would agree that that's viewpoint-based. So I think she's not saying all compelled speech is necessarily going to be different. It's possible to compel viewpoints with compelled speech too. She just thought they're compelling factual speech was different.
It makes it more like the mandatory disclosure in commercial speech, that like cases like Zouderer, I think. Yeah,
right.
Again, taking what she said, maybe that's the way to think about it from her perspective.
It is interesting, right? I mean, it's interesting that Zouderer comes up in the case that is clearly not about commercial commercial speech in the sense that in the, or at least traditionally understood in NIFLA, where there is no exchange of dollars. Here you have a case that is a licensed counselor who is doing this for a living. And there was basically no discussion in the opinion of that being particularly relevant to the analysis here. Obviously, she's licensed, but the licensing of the counselor, there's not really much of a discussion at all in this case about the fact that she's paid.
Yeah, there shouldn't be. Commercial speech isn't speech for money.
Yeah.
Commercial speech is speech that invites a commercial transaction. If you own a bookstore and you have a sign outside that says buy your books here, that's commercial speech. The books for sale inside the bookstore are not commercial speech, that's ordinary speech. And so here the speech that she is engaged in is this, her talk therapy. She sells the talk therapy. To the extent she's advertising her talk therapy, only then is she engaged in commercial speech. And so there is some notion, there's been some confusion out there that paid for speech is somehow commercial speech, and therefore paid for speech is less protected. The Supreme Court has never said that. In fact, they have long said the opposite. Paid for speech is protected just as much as free speech is free speech.
Yeah, and let me emphasize that for a minute. I mean, New York Times versus Sullivan, the New York Times gets money for its speech. So it'd be crazy if any speech that got money was just commercial speech. The Sistine Chapel was commissioned and paid for. Most great artists were. Would be weird to say that that's no longer protected speech anymore. You're right. That's not how the doctrine works.
Yeah, it is interesting that the way you will see this case in many of these cases, frankly, that have, especially the Colorado series of cases, the way you will see them discussed often in the media, definitely online, is very different from the actual conversations, the doctrines that are actually playing themselves out in the court's opinions. To Paul's point about how maybe between NIFLA and now, some of these examples about how, states really could start using this, begins to impact things. I mean, certainly, I mean, you give an example, but I think, and Cliff Strickland in the comments here is asking about Attorney General Paxton, who issued an opinion toward the end of March, saying that mental health care providers in Texas who facilitate medical interventions for kids, can violate state law, and is it basically asking about the comparison there? So using that, also just pointing out, I think from the opinion itself, they're using sort of the mirror example of a state deciding that we're going to prohibit counselors from affirming someone's sexual orientation or gender identity, for example, right? And that doesn't seem like a wild hypothetical. It seems like it wouldn't shock me at all if one of those laws, if this opinion had gone the other way, if one of those laws had not been passed, it would be entirely unsurprising, I think, in sort of the current political dynamic. How much do you think that actually ends up impacting at least some of the justices, particularly maybe Justices Kagan and Sotomayor, and their understanding of what actually is likely to happen or could very well happen in the world. And Paul, you're welcome to jump in first if you'd like, but either way.
I mean, it is the proof that the threat was always there. Again, NIFLA talks about the threat of the state basically imposing its views through occupational licensing. Yeah. What we have seen is that threat was always real and not just a hypothetical. And so it has a way of focusing the mind.
Something I'll add to that is, I think it depends on, is this going to be speech that is bound up in conduct that the state has the ability to regulate? So if it's speech that someone is providing about medical transition one way or the other that is necessary to or incidental to the actual medical procedure of, hormone therapy or a surgery, then the state is going to have more leeway to license that sort of speech, period. But if it's just like the state's trying to prohibit certain medical procedures, and they also want to prohibit any therapist from engaging in talk therapy to affirm or encourage such procedures, that feels much more like the flip side of Chiles, the type of situation that would be protected. That we can, in fact, Justice Gorsuch asked a question to Colorado about this and seemed concerned about the fact that the rule Colorado was asking for would have allowed states to have laws prohibiting counselors from engaging in talk therapy that affirmed someone's LGBTQ status. And so I think that, and Colorado said, yeah, like our rule would allow for counselors to be regulated in that way. I think the court found that troubling. And I think their rule in Childs would protect counselors going either direction in either viewpoint for that sort of talk therapy when it comes to gender transitions or other procedures like that.
Yeah. One of the most important facts of this case is that all that Childs does is talk. She doesn't, there's literally no conduct involved. It's just talking. It will be more difficult if you are doing a surgical procedure and you are talking, how that's the, those are like the informed consent cases, or especially like in the abortion context where the court has said, well, some of these are okay and some of them aren't. The question is going to be, how close is the tie between the regulated conduct and the speech that comes along with it? There's a fun case out of the Ninth Circuit from several years ago called Connett, where the U.S. Supreme Court had said, of course, we can restrict doctors prescribing marijuana to people. The question was, well, can doctors talk to their patients about the beneficial uses of marijuana? And the Ninth Circuit says, yes, of course they can. Just talking to people is speech. Prescribing something is literally words on a piece of paper. But the reason the government is regulating is because that gives you access to controlled substances. Accessing controlled substances is conduct. So that speech conduct distinction is critical, as NIFLA said it was. And in this case, it was pretty easy because there was literally no conduct at all.
Yeah. It's the, I think as the opinion describes, part of the rationale for that, right, is that the alternative is that you're in a world where the state can essentially prescribe this shall be the medical opinion that shall be delivered to people, and then it can't be challenged, right? It can't develop. And I think it's sort of in a particularly in a post-COVID world, I think you probably have a lot of people who are a lot more attuned to the problems of the government saying this is the answer about whether or not this treatment is effective. And that's the only thing that can be communicated to people. Whether you can actually go forward with an actual intervention, a physical intervention, is one thing, right? Whether you can prescribe ivermectin, for example, may be one question. Whether you can say, look, I disagree with what the state is saying here. I think they're wrong, but right. Those are words, and it's a very different thing. And it's necessary to make sure that we're actually getting this thing right, right? That you actually can have dissent within the medical profession, within the scientific community.
And that, by the way, is I've seen online some critics like, well, they just said in Scrimeti that we're supposed to defer to the legislature, which is what Scrimeti does say, but Scrimeti is also very narrow. That was about the prescribing of certain medications for certain treatments. That's conduct. That's accessing controlled substances. And so to the extent that Scrimeti is addressing sort of in the same area, it is very much a conduct case. It's very much not a speech case. And,
right.
That's not the mirror image.
Not only is Scrimeti not a speech case, but it's also not an equal protection case, is what it was. One of the things the court was dealing with there. Is it some sort of suspect class under the Constitution that then requires strict scrutiny? And the answer is no. And so the default, if we don't have a protected constitutional right at issue, is that we're going to give deference. And here there is a protected constitutional right at issue. And so the deference gets flipped around, and then we're giving scrutiny, not deference.
Yeah, because this is a speech. Yeah,
it's constitutional right. And there's no constitutional right at issue in Scrimeti.
So I'm the beginning of Justice Jackson's dissent, which is actually a little bit longer than the rest of the opinions put together. The beginning of her dissent, we'll read from it. There is no right to practice medicine which is not subordinate to the police power of the states. And that's citing a 1926 case in Lambert. This was true 100 years ago, and it should be true today. Obviously, there is a conflict there between a lot of what we've been discussing. That's the main point of contention. But were you at all surprised by the, I thought that was a large assertion to make as sort of the centerpiece of an argument that you're going to make, that because the state has the power to regulate medicine, that is the sort of core question here. And that sort of all of the rights arguments kind of flow from the state has this power. Were you surprised at it's kind of the breadth of that assertion at the outset of the opinion?
Yeah. Can you imagine if we took that logic to its logical conclusion in other contexts? The state has the power to regulate schools, and therefore there's no free exercise right in the school context. Oh, wait, except the court just decided, Mahmoud. The state has the right to regulate parades, road safety, and therefore there's no freedom of speech rights to have parades and protests. Like, it just is this wild carve out that would basically erase First Amendment protections and say anytime the police power is in play, that's the end of the analysis. And of course, she doesn't believe that. She doesn't apply that elsewhere. The question under constitutional rights is the government using its police power appropriately, given the fact that here we have reason to be more skeptical about how and for what justifications the government is using that police power. That's the entire point of having a constitutional right. Her framework would negate the existence of our Bill of Rights, basically.
So Justice Jackson's opinion is again just the professional speech doctrine all over again, and that the doctrine essentially works like this, and the doctrine basically finds its origin in an opinion, not a majority opinion, by Justice White in a case called Lowe v. SEC back in the 1980s, and so far as I can and it's cited in Justice Jackson's dissent, and so far as I can tell, she is the only justice since Lowe v. SEC to cite that Justice White's opinion favorably. So that's how we know that it's the professional speech doctrine all over again. And what that doctrine says is essentially not all speech is speech. Sometimes speech is the practice of some occupation. And when it is the practice of some occupation, then it isn't speech at all. It is just conduct. That's why she continually calls it treatment. Below there's a particularly Orwellian phrase below where it was treatment speech, which was conduct. And this is the relabeling game, right? Ordinarily we would know it's speech, but because it occurs in this, you know, special context, then we know it's not speech, it's conduct. And states have been trying, governments have been trying to play this relabeling game for a long time to get themselves out of free speech protections, and not just in the professional occupational speech context. There's a 11th Amendment 11th Circuit case a couple of years ago called honeyfund.com, where Florida was trying to prohibit mandatory DEI trainings. And so they passed this law that essentially prohibited mandatory DEI trainings. But their argument was, we haven't prohibited the content. We haven't prohibited the training. What we've prohibited is the meeting. And meeting is conduct. Therefore, this is not a speech regulation. The 11th Circuit saw through that real quick. Speech is speech, even when it's uttered by a professional, even when it's uttered in a relationship with a patient or a client. And so again, Justice Jackson's decision is just the professional speech doctrine that was thoroughly rejected in NIFLA.
So on some of the questions here, we have a couple of questions, and I'll throw in another example. We have a couple of questions about implications of the decision for other areas, professional speech codes. You've got the fight over Rule 8.4G but kind of the professional speech code question generally for lawyers, for real estate brokers, different folks like that. And then I'll throw in another example that occurred to me, just because we recently had those trial court decisions on the social media cases that both came out within the last week or so, right? Where a large part of the question is, well, are the design choices made by social media platforms, are those conduct or are they speech? Is the, you know, the algorithms themselves speech? So kind of unfairly tossing all those examples to you, but I welcome any others that come to your mind about sort of the implications of this decision, perhaps for other areas outside of the the fact pattern here.
I can take on the 8.4 rule question. So the question is about what is the implication, if any, of this court's ruling in Childs on the ABA's model rule 8.4G that exposes attorneys to discipline if they run afoul of some of the requirements that the ABA has. And I'll discuss those in more depth in just a second. So this actually was something that was flagged by the, I believe, the Christian Legal Society's amicus brief. And so what 8.4 does is it says that it will be professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status in conduct related to the practice of law. But then importantly, comment 3 defines discrimination to include, quote, harmful verbal or physical conduct that manifests bias or prejudice. So note that they're defining words to be the type of conduct that the ABA is applying to. So this is one area where Childs immediately puts pressure. Is it saying, just because you have given us the label of conduct, it's not like in Star Wars, this is not the speech you were looking for. You don't get to just magic that away. It's still verbal that the rule is ultimately defining it towards. So that sort of distinction isn't going to help insulate the ABA rule anymore after Childs, to the extent it ever was. And so this rule has been contested by some, arguing that it violates lawyers' freedom of speech rights in respect to maybe their religious beliefs or political views, and can have a chilling effect on expression. Some states, like I believe the Texas Attorney General, has concluded that it violates First Amendment rights. So some of the ways in which Childs, I think, continues to put vulnerability on this sort of dispute is that Childs again affirms what NIFLA said, which is that professional licensing doesn't diminish First Amendment protection. That means that First Amendment applies to attorneys as well. The majority, again, flatly states that professional speech is not in some separate category of speech subject to diminished constitutional protection, as Paul points out. Then also, in addition to the mere labels point I addressed, the third is that I think Childs has some relevance here for what counts as viewpoint discrimination. So to the extent 8.4 is prohibiting attorneys from expressing a certain view that the rule is defining as demeaning on certain topics, while permitting speech on that same topic that is affirming or supportive, then that potentially runs into the same sort of trouble that Colorado has. Now, how does this cut with the sort of history and tradition analysis? That might be where a lot of the action happens under this dispute. I think one argument against saying that 8.4 is saved by some sort of history or tradition is that while attorney regulation does have far deeper historical pedigree than, say, counselor regulation, there's centuries of licensing, there's some requirements going back to the founding, the Childs majority stressed that we have to look at the right level of generality, and also that traditional licensing regimes focused on qualifications, not the professional's point of view. And so, like, what did you have to do to be a qualified professional? Not what orthodoxy did you have to adopt in order to practice this profession? And so to the extent that Rule 8.4 looks more like the latter and less like the former, then I think it could potentially run into problems, especially if it's being applied in ways that are leading to sanctions or other sorts of harms that give standing in the First Amendment context.
Right. So 2 points on lawyer speech. One is, again, NIFLA says the ordinary rules apply. And so a big ordinary rule is forum analysis. Courtrooms are not public forum. Even if you're a licensed attorney, you can't get up and deliver a mathematics lecture in an oral argument. So a lot of what we're talking about here wouldn't apply to rules that govern in-court behavior, words, et cetera, by lawyers. The second one, and an issue we haven't really touched on yet, because Childs is a licensed professional case, is what about speech licensing restrictions that affect non-licensed persons? So current modern unauthorized practice of law rules prohibit non-lawyers from giving legal advice. Well, what is legal advice, and in what context is this true? And especially given the history and tradition where out of court legal advice wasn't really regulated as the practice of law until maybe the early 20th century. Like, there's a case from the Second Circuit. It's an IJ case, so full disclosure, called Upsolve, where a nonprofit wants to use trained but non-lawyer volunteers to help people fill out basic forms for debtors court. Is that legal advice? The New York says it is legal advice, and the Second Circuit said, well, it's also free speech. And so that case is still being litigated, but there will be more of those kinds of cases as well. And in fact, the court has been holding a couple of additional cases, I think for Childs. So we'll see if those cases are GVR'd or otherwise acted on in the next couple of weeks.
Great. All right. We are getting to the end of our time here. So I will toss it open this way and ask both Paul and Professor Barclay. And we'll start with you, Paul, and then go to Professor Barclay. What's a question I didn't ask that I should have? How would you like, what's the observation you had basically coming out of this case that you think is noteworthy that we have not yet talked about?
I do think that it's my personal interest here is in the cases that don't involve licensed professionals, where a practicing or a practice act of some kind has been used to prohibit speech by non-licensed people. So one of the cases the Supreme Court is holding, again, in the interest of full disclosure, is a case of mine out of the Ninth Circuit, where a guy who does not have a surveyor's license, because he's not a surveyor, got in trouble for the unlicensed practice of surveying because he was copying GIS data onto drawings and then selling the drawings. And the California said that that's the practice of surveying without a license. We made a free speech argument. All he's doing is using information to create more information for sale. That's clearly free speech. That's Sorrell v. IMS. And the court said, well, no, because what he's doing is he's actually, California is regulating conduct, the conduct of practicing surveying, which is, again, probably mostly conduct when you get down to it. But all my guy is doing is speech. How does that work out? The court said, well, no, that's not how that works. This is just incidentally regulating his speech, even though he's not engaged in any conduct. Childs, I think, pretty clearly puts an end to that sort of analysis, which was something we were seeing nationwide with regard to non-licensed persons, although there was a circuit split on that as well. So I think that's another thing that has been cleaned up by Childs and that will allow those sorts of cases to move forward as well.
Mr. Barclay?
One thing that
you get the last word here.
Sure. And thanks for these great questions and for everyone who participated with good questions. One thing that I think is important here is there are, I think, a lot of good faith individuals who are legitimately worried about the mental health issues that are affecting young people who are dealing with gender dysphoria, who want to pursue gender transitions. Like, how do we help them? How do we not repeat some of the bad lessons from the past of true bad therapies, like shock therapy and other coercive treatments that were problematic? And Justice Gorsuch isn't questioning Colorado's sincerity here. He doesn't accuse the state of being a bad actor necessarily. He talks about, you know, there is this issue of all of the mounting mental health risks that young people face. And Colorado may regard its policy as essential to public health and safety, is something that Justice Gorsuch talks about. But that's what I think makes his next sentence really land when he says, certainly, censorious governments throughout history have believed the same. And I think this rhetorical move is deliberate. Justice Gorsuch and the majority are making the point that good intentions are constitutionally insufficient. When we're dealing with First Amendment rights, we have to look for more than that. We have to look for an evidentiary basis that really the type of government action here is necessary to prevent this sort of wrong, this sort of harm. And so the First Amendment is reflecting this judgment that every American possesses the right to think and speak freely, including those in a marketplace, including those who are professionals. And sometimes we need professionals most to be able to express their views so that we can get more information out there that will be helpful, that will increase the patient autonomy and the ability of these clients to make their own decisions that are consistent with what they think is going to help then be able to have happy, fulfilling lives. And I think that's one reason why Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan joined on, which shows that this isn't just an ideological opinion. It's an attempt to make sure that when government does these sorts of things, whether motivated well or not, there's a real justification for what government is doing. And the last thing I'll point out is what I began with, the majority opinion still leaves lots of room for governments to regulate in lots of ways. If there is evidence of real coercion, that the minor is being forced to engage in therapy the minor doesn't want to, that's a reason why a state could regulate. If there's, you know, if it's aversive sort of techniques or other problematic conversion therapy that's happening, those laws are still on the books. The majority's ruling doesn't invalidate those, but it is saying when you're just trying to skew the marketplace of ideas and say only this perspective receives protection and this perspective doesn't, the government's just picking winners and losers on important issues where we need more good thinking, more professional speech, then the First Amendment is going to subject that to the most exacting scrutiny.
Excellent. We'll invite Libby back on. Thank you to both of you for your insights. And again, on short notice, we've only had 48 hours to sit with this opinion and had a pretty significant day of arguments yesterday at the court in the interim. So appreciate your weighing in here. Thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this conversation. And thank you, Libby, for making this possible.
Wonderful. Well, I will echo all of that. Thank you all three for joining us today, for sharing your expertise and insights into this very important topic. And Casey, thank you for moderating. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.